All right. And my next guest is President Mayo Clinic Platform, Dr. John Halamka, as well as author Paul Serrato. Gentlemen, are you there?
Yep, we are indeed.
Yep, excellent. Thank you. Welcome back to the show.
Sure, my pleasure.
So I must...
It was great to listen to my friends Anish and Rasu.
Exactly. Thank you, John. But I'm going to take a point of privilege here just because I would love for you to give a 10-second plug of where you're calling in from. I hope you're calling in from Unity Farm Sanctuary, John.
I, in fact, am at Unity Farm Sanctuary, though tomorrow I'll be heading to Mayo Clinic Jacksonville because I did promise my Florida colleagues that I'd spend several days with them. Cancellation with hymns has just required us to be agile.
Excellent. Well, I love what you, I'm part of that community. I love what you do there, your generosity, your giving back. But obviously the show today is about your leadership in the industry. But I love the Unity Farm Sanctuary. So I always like to bring it up, as you know, thank you. So John and Paul, Paul, assume you're calling in from upstate New York as usual.
Yes. From my home office in Warwick, New York.
Excellent. So let's start off with just what trends to follow the show here. What health IT trends are you guys seeing in the industry? So, John, I'll start off with you, and then Paul would love for you to chime in with yours.
Sure. Well, so I joined Mayo Clinic January 1st, and the three major areas that I'm working on are, first, how do you take large amounts of data from the past and use it to inspire new cures and optimal care plans for patients in the future? Do that in an ethical way that's a privacy-protecting way and a way that's scalable and allows you to participate with multiple constituents, payers, providers, patients, pharma, all learning together. The second area is, how do I take a high acuity patient and care for them in a non-traditional setting, mm-hmm. in your home? And as we think about lowering costs, as we think about COVID-19, mm-hmm. we're going to have to start delivering care in places other than bricks and mortar. And finally, how do we take the novel signals we're getting from your wearables in your home and turn those into wisdom with AI algorithms that bring you value? Because right now you're wearing things, but who's looking at the data and what can you do with it?
Oh, I just got a hashtag in there. Wearables wisdom. I love that, John. That's great. Perfect. Paul, what are some of your thoughts and trends that you're seeing, my friend?
You know, it's funny. John and I have been working together for so many years that we're starting to finish one another's sentences, as he has said before.
Yes.
And when he mentioned, you know, the talk about moving from brick and mortar to virtual care, that was on my list. It's happening, and we've got to be prepared for it. And the two major buckets are telemedicine and hospital at home. Those are the two movements that have the most traction. And as John mentioned, with the coronavirus being such a big issue to say telemedicine is certainly one of the ways to address that problem. But in order to make that doable, we have to have a better understanding of what type of remote patient monitoring systems work and which ones don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think if there's a positive that can come out of all this right now with what's happening across the country and across our world, as I opened the show with as well, is that we are going to start to hyperspeed. I think the promise of telehealth, the reimbursement for telehealth, virtual care, remote patient monitoring, just remote care in general, and platforms around that. I mean, we've all known, we've been in this industry for a long time in the forefront of it. We know what it can do for us. We know its efficacy. In many cases, there are always many use cases, but we've been very slow, I think, to support it properly in different care strategies and care settings. But I think now it's going to be moved to the forefront. We see what North Carolina is doing. They've started reimbursing basically full fare as of Monday for visits, you know, whether you're in office or virtual care, certainly, you know, via telehealth. So I think we're going to see more of that. So if something positive can come out of all of this, it's certainly moving all of these technology innovations to the forefront. But
absolutely.
What best practices or strategies can you guys help share for us to navigate those trends from your individual perspective? So Paul, I'll start off with you. What are some of the things that you would share there?
I think, as I just mentioned earlier, we have to distinguish between what remote patient monitoring systems really work and which ones that don't have much support or just are silly and useless. I mean, you take things like glucose monitors. Obviously, they've been in use for a long time and they're effective. Just recently, the FDA approved a glucose monitor that does not require finger pricking, which is a major problem for a lot of patients. So there's a little monitor that people put under their skin, and then all you have to do is put the glucose meter right next to the monitor, and it tells you how much your blood glucose levels are. So that's the type of technology. Yes, we know it works. Let's push forward with it. Where some of the less useful and sometimes silly monitoring systems, one that comes in mind, I wrote about a couple of years ago, there is a booty that newborns can wear. So the new patients put this little boot on the child's foot, and it monitors their blood pressure, it monitors their heart rate, and so on and so forth. Totally useless for some a normal, healthy child. And in fact, the American Pediatrics Society has come out saying that you're probably doing more harm than good for that kind of patient monitoring. So obviously, you know, we've got to be discriminating when we use these type of tools.
Very, very good point. Totally agree. John, what would you like to share there? Best practices.
2 points. I think Paul is exactly right. We have all these novel sources of telemetry and figuring out the provenance, what devices generate what signals for what utility. But also, we're getting so much data, we're going to overwhelm our clinicians. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how do we separate signal from noise? And the answer there has to be machine learning used to augment human decision making. So that as we get these terabytes of new signals, the humans get engaged when there's something material to review, and figuring out how to build platforms that ingest the data and connect them to partner companies that do the machine learning processing is a lot of my effort. But also protecting privacy. And that's, of course, a really challenging thing to do as you generate more data for more purposes. And so much of what I've also focused on is how does one de-identify the data? Or let's just say this, lower the re-identification threshold so substantially that the data can flow to multiple parties while also ensuring that patient privacy is respected.
That's excellent. So on that note, and kind of pivoting over to the new interoperability rule, because obviously some of this is covered in there, what would you like to share? I'd love to know what you thought of the rule yesterday, John, and certainly Paul, if you have anything you want to add. But I'd love to know your thoughts, as we, you know, we'll have Dr. Rucker on at 2 p.m. today, but would love to send me your preview there.
Sure. So I think it's, as Anish said, it's cultural and it's ecosystem. It's suddenly, instead of walking into the basement of medical records Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, asking for your medical record and being asked, would you like that single or double-sided?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
The culture will be, it's an expectation of digital first, and you can't say no. I mean, there are 8 exceptions. Yes. I get it, right? But I mean, in general, the answer is hospitals and clinics will be offering a digital channel for patients to become stewards of their own data. And that's really a cultural change.
That's fantastic. Did you like anything else about the rule?
Well, I thought it was extraordinarily accommodating to mm-hmm. all the players in our environment, right? I mean, we all know there was a lot of controversy about yes. what would the rule require in terms of intellectual property disclosure and fees and all the rest. And I think the folks at ONC worked pretty hard with our stakeholders to come up with something that everyone would say is reasonable.
Yep. I agree. I heard accommodating is one of the terms that I heard last night as a few of us were digesting the day and the comments and the different calls that we were on. So I completely agree. John or Paul, anything else you want to add to that?
Yeah, I've got mixed feelings about this new rule.
Please.
I think a year from today, we'll be able to answer the question, yes, it does work, or no, it doesn't. But earlier this morning, I looked at the HHS news release about this new rule. And I've been doing this for, you know, working as a medical journalist for about 30 years. And this news release was a lot different than a lot of the others that I read, because it spent the first 3 or 4 paragraphs, and it looked more like a political campaign release than an explanation about how the rule works. So I don't know how much of this is political grandstanding and how much of this is actually going to benefit patients down the road. So we'll see.
Well, I think the ONC has been so, I think, just battered from all sides. So I think they almost had to put a statement like this together to kind of pacify everybody to the best of their ability, knowing they probably couldn't, but they had to at least give it a shot. That's my take on it, because I agree with you.
You're probably right.
Yeah. They are a very nonpartisan group, in my opinion, but they have a lot of politics to navigate. Let's just say that. So,
sure.
John, I know my audience would love to hear more about your new role as president of Mayo Clinic Platform. What would you like to share regarding that, your new post?
Sure. So Mayo Clinic has enormous talent and reputation. And the question is, how can you share that broadly with a world that, as we know from COVID-19, is shrinking every day? Mm. And the idea is, can you take the AI algorithms that have been developed by Mayo Clinic experts or the content or care plans and make that broadly available through a variety of channels so that there can be much more extended benefit? And Platform is really that. It's how do you connect producers of innovation with consumers of innovation and do it to very large scale with very low friction. And so my challenge, of course, is in 2020, I'm expected to have a series of major go lives once a quarter. And so I would tell you, this is probably a bit of a sprint, but it's also a marathon. So am I sprinting a marathon? All I can tell you is it brings me joy every day. And that's what's important.
I love it. It's very optimistic. It's great. I've read what your go live plan is. So it's impressive. It's monumental. And we obviously look forward to watching the journey. So, and thank you again, I know you got a busy schedule, for joining us. Do you want to join in? You have a quick question here?
Monica? John, this is Roberta from Healthcare Now Radio. Just want to know if your Boston Marathon's going to go on this year.
Oh, good question.
I read that this morning.
Wow.
Do you know?
You know, if they've canceled the St. Patrick's Day parade, isn't that a harbinger? I don't know. I have no inside information.
All right.
Yeah, that's actually a great question.
Neither does Roberta. The Atlanta Journal have much
to say about ours.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but I think what you could say this is that we are seeing the catchwords abundance of caution being used in virtually every public event. So I take that to probably mean public events of that magnitude will be canceled.
Yep. I tend to agree. So I think looking over, closing out there with Mayo a little bit, would be a couple initiatives, AI or machine learning, artificial intelligence, machine learning initiatives that Mayo is launching this year, John, or that you plan to launch over the next year or so?
Right. So the first, which we just finished the comprehensive de-identification of 9 million historical records. And we'll be moving those into a secure container where we can invite innovators into the secure container to run AI algorithms. Wow. That is, the data will never leave our control. Yep. It's fully de-identified and certified as de-identified, but we can invite innovators in. And I think that's a really interesting model. And so you'll start seeing the first invitations, if you will, happening in April and May of this year. Wow. Going live with Home Hospital. And to the comments Paul made, we believe that it's going to be increasingly important in society to have this capability. And our first home hospital go live is in Florida in July, our second in Northwest Wisconsin in August. We're trying just two totally different geographies, supply chains, reimbursement mechanisms, and ecosystems. And we'll learn a great deal as to how this can scale. And then I am increasingly working on connecting the devices, the kind of things that Paul described, to algorithms. And by the end of the year, you should start to see some of those algorithms applied to some of the devices we're wearing today.
Wow. That's amazing. All the best there. That's phenomenal. I did not know about the home hospital. So terrific. So let's pivot now to your new book that you guys co-authored, Reinventing Clinical Decision Support. So let's talk about, Paul, why don't you start off here? You know, the promise of AI, the book talks about the promise of AI and machine learning and helping docs make better clinical decisions. But what are some of the barriers and limitations of these new tools?
Probably the two most important two that we were going to talk about at the HIMSS conference were resistance from clinicians and the relative lack of scientific evidence to support some of these tools. Resistance, we've spoken about that often. part of the resistance comes from not understanding the complex data science behind some of these AI tools. And one easy way to address that is better education. We were planning to give a presentation where we showed a video of how convolutional neural networks work. And then I also had a video to show how random forest modeling works. Those are two foundational stones used to do machine learning and AI. So education is one of the first steps, which, by the way, if any of your listeners are interested in those videos, they can email me and I can send it to them directly. I'm at serato@aol.com. And then the second issue, relative lack of evidence. There are thousands of scientific papers out there about machine learning and AI as it applies to healthcare. But most of them are proof of concept papers or retrospective studies. That's really not the kind of high-level research that we need in order to put this into daily practice and risk patients' health. So one of the things that I had planned to hand out at the conference was a list of about 10 or 15 studies, randomized controlled trials, prospective trials that show the strongest amount of evidence for certain categories of machine learning. So once again, anybody interested in that handout, serato@aol.com. I'll be happy to send it to them.
Yeah, and we also broadcast a show, had you both on a couple weeks ago, so they can also go check out your radio show, This Justin Radio. There's all my shows listed. You guys were just a few weeks ago, and that was a phenomenal show. We actually did a double episode, so almost an hour, just focused primarily on reinventing clinical decision support in this new book. It's fascinating. So this is just a real kind of, we're just touching on it today, but we did an in-depth double episode a couple weeks ago. So everybody can certainly check that out and look Paul up there. So John, what else would you like to add to that? I mean, how can we make, docs make better clinical decisions in that regard, and some of the barriers?
A couple of thoughts. Justin, you have been interviewing many, many people. How many clinicians have told you how much they love their EHR regarding a brand or vendor?
None.
Yeah, well, and so, yes, those tools are fit for purpose. I mean, sure. In the sense that they're required by regulation and there are certain compliance issues. So I get that.
Right.
But most clinicians would say, on the whole, this is a burden. It isn't a tool I look forward to using every day. So to Paul's point, if you bring those validated algorithms and workflow enhancements into the EHR as an external product that's sitting within the framework of the EHR that reduces the time spent, reduces the administrative burden, brings more confidence in decision making, the hope is you can restore some of the joy in practice. And I was recently visiting a large software company somewhere in Wisconsin. Can't imagine which one. And the senior leadership embraces that idea of taking everything that's in the book and making it through Fire CDS hooks available within the workflow of the EHR to enhance the usefulness of the EHR, recognizing it will take a village of third parties to do so.
Fantastic. Yeah. And we're all supportive of what electronic health records can do, should do, and need to do. So for the record, we're highly supportive because they're essential functions and infrastructures to our healthcare system. Would you agree with that, John?
There is no question that EHRs are needed, but my hope is they become a bit more of a back office function.
Yeah.
And that is ambient listening technologies and some of these AI tools we've been talking about become more what the doctors and nurses are interacting with every day.
Completely agree. Excellent. And our remaining 30 seconds, I guess, what would you say we should be looking on the horizon for AI and machine learning living up to its potential? What do we need to do?
John, you want to take that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So we talk a lot about how the healthcare system is broken and fragmented, but frankly, AI, to a large extent, is fragmented as well. So many providers are only using one aspect of AI, like the predictive analytics aspect. But what we really need is an integrated approach, which includes predictive analytics, prescriptive analytics, and AI that helps with patient engagement. So you have the entire universe from soup to nuts, as they say.
Excellent. Fascinating. Gentlemen, Paul Serrato, Dr. John Halamka, you guys both are amazing guests, great supporters of the show, and thank you so much for joining us today. Have a great afternoon, my friends.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.